The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, and financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing. Investment advice offered through Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. Welcome to the Financial Focus Radio Show with your hosts, Tyler Simonis and Josh Finelli. Join us as we discuss markets, bring transparency to issues within the financial services industry, and bring honest, thoughtful analysis every week.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Financial Focus Radio. Thanks for joining us. I am back from my Italian holiday where I was cruising around on wooden boats, and you know, I wasn't doing any of that stuff, but I did enjoy my time in Italy and Croatia. But now I am back to the reality that is Financial Focus Radio. So hopefully nobody missed me too much. I know there was some groupies down in Texas that might have missed me, but I'm back, so you guys can get your fill of me.
It's a gloomy end of June here.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Finelli. How goes the battle? Your wife must be loving life now that both boys are out of school for the summer.
Yeah. Summer camps are pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
And having a four-year-old is awesome.
Yeah. It was, it was the best age ever. Young Matthias, Josh's youngest son's fourth birthday last week, and he came to the office with a box of where's that place, the donut place?
Richard's Donuts.
Richard's Donuts. He came with a box of Richard's Donuts, and I never saw a four-year-old eat a donut as fast as Matthias did, but
just like his dad.
Life is good when you're 4 years old and it's summertime. He likes to stick his whole hand in holes where there could be potentially snakes or lizards. And so hopefully that doesn't go badly.
It's a little mini Steve Irwin.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's talk about the week that was in the capital markets. U.S. stocks, as measured by the good old S&P 500, traded down 1.75%. So there's been a little bit of a rout in the technology space as of late, as it appears that we're going to get higher rates on the horizon. But we can talk some more about that in a second. The one anomaly that Josh and I are having a hard time understanding is the small cap outperformance continues pretty dramatically. U.S. small cap stocks were up 1% last week when the large cap markets were down about 2%. So dramatic outperformance. And over the last 5 years, small caps totally traded on where rates were going. But if you go back even further to the last time the tech telecom media bubble burst in the early 2000s, that was because rates were, you know, went higher and then tech stocks sold off. But small caps did really well in that 2000 through 2010 market. And it is precisely why we continue to hold them
and
as
an
allocation.
I think importantly, like the Russell 2000 really underperforming kind of the small caps that we actually use in our own allocation. But the higher quality side of the small cap space dramatically outperforming the broader small cap index that's talked about on financial news channels.
International developed markets, so think Western Europe, Japan, those kind of markets, those traded down 1.5%. In the emerging markets, we saw almost a 5% sell-off last week as the tech sell-off really hit countries like Taiwan and South Korea. Stocks, you know, they were on Monday, those markets traded limit down.
The South Korean meme trade.
Yeah, so
memory stocks.
EM stocks sold off sharply the last week. That was solely tech-related. In the bond market, we saw the aggregate bond index trade up by 0.5% from a price perspective, which means yields were lower. The yield on a one-year treasury, 3.94. A 10-year treasury yields 4.38. And a 30-year yields 4.87%. Gold traded lower again at down 3.2% at $41.06 an ounce. And obviously, thankfully, some good news in the oil markets. Oil was down another 10% last week at $69 a barrel. So it broke that $70 a barrel mark, which will certainly help the U.S. consumer.
Kevin Warsh did his part to undermine the dollar debasement trade narrative.
Yeah, well, we can talk a little bit more about him in a second. The other thing is, we don't talk about it on this show, but because of the move, it's been so dramatic. Crypto, Bitcoin specifically, traded down another 6%. It broke 60,000 last week. As we're speaking, it's probably right at about 60,000. So the crypto route has continued to go lower. So that's been pretty interesting.
Well, got to say, we love to see it.
I love to see Michael Saylor and all the pain that he's in, because he is the modern-day snake oil salesman. So the big news on the U.S. economy last week was the Federal Reserve's favorite gauge of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, say that five times fast, or PCE. That grew by 0.4% in the month of May and 4.1% on a year-over-year basis. Obviously, inflation is double the Federal Reserve's target. The Fed says they want inflation at 2%, even though them saying that it's been way above that for 5 years now is sort of laughable. But this comes, this data on the PCE comes after Kevin Warsh, the new Fed chairman, said that in his first post-interest rate decision, that the Fed will be focused on prices and fighting inflation, which is code for we are going to be hiking rates, which is very interesting. And you know, I think Kevin Warsh is the right man for the job at the right time. I think he's a really smart guy. He understands how the economy works. But it is ultra surprising, I think, for me and for Josh, for why the president selected him. Knowing that the president wants rates lower, it is interesting. But I think that he's a hawk, and so it's going to be really interesting to see how long the president goes before he starts to throw him under the bus. It's very clear to me that the governors of the Fed wanted to hike interest rates at their last meeting, but the market would have been way off size. Markets would have sold off limit down if they had hiked rates without the market knowing. But the reason that Kevin Warsh said a lot of the things he said, which were certainly a surprise and probably why we've seen tech stocks sell off since that meeting, is that they are telegraphing for the market, preparing the market for rates, for Fed rates. Rate hikes. Now, the data could change, right? And the Fed could change their mind, which I think is the Fed is open to, which certainly wouldn't be bad for stocks. But I think that the Fed is trying to telegraph to the market, look, prepare yourself for higher rates so that when it happens, the market's not surprised.
I talked a lot about, in your absence, the Warsh emphasized the sort of change of communication style. But also I spoke quite a bit about, you know, he had this very big fear around moral hazard, because when all market participants were acting like the Fed always was going to have their back, because they knew exactly what the Fed was going to do, because they essentially forward communicated, they weren't going to deviate from expectation is what they communicated to try to essentially dampen volatility. And he wants to, I think, in the big picture, sort of reintroduce moral hazard to avoid sort of those over-exuberant market allocation decisions where you just have this unbridled risk-taking as a result of always thinking the Fed is going to bail you out.
And Alan Greenspan, who just died last week at 100, introduced that where the Fed or the market participants felt like the Fed would always have their back. And I'm all for it. I mean, Kevin Warsh could go back to the days of Paul Volcker, which is, you know, making the U.S. economy take our medicine and actually having market clearing events. We'll see. He might get hung by his fingernails if that happens. But
a lot of rich people are not going to be very pleased with
you. He might disappear in the middle of the night on the way to the Fed. The housing market obviously continues to struggle. I would say that I wouldn't expect much appreciation in the housing market in the years to come based on this, you know, higher rate situation. The one thing that was confusing last week, and it wasn't the savior for the housing market, but it would have put us sort of on a course towards the housing market improving over time with the more supply, is this bipartisan bill that made it through Congress and the president is, I guess, refusing to sign. The good news is if he doesn't veto it and the time goes by, I guess it'll pass on its own. But that one was a head scratcher to me, that he wouldn't sign that bill, that it obviously was bipartisan in nature, and I think ultimately long term good, because it got rid of a lot of the red tape in getting houses built, environmental stuff, and so I think that hopefully will go through without the president vetoing it, and help the housing market longer term and getting houses built quicker. All right, if you would like to take one of us up on a free retirement review, one of us will give you an hour of our time to talk about anything in your financial life. So if you have at least $750,000 of investable assets, call our office to get one of those meetings scheduled, 800-743-0988, or email us, go to our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to take withdrawals from your retirement accounts in the most tax-efficient manner. So stick around.
Get your free one-hour retirement review. Meet with a Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management Investment Advisor today for free. It's our offer to you as a listener to the show. Give us a call today to schedule your portfolio review. 800-743-0988. Again, 800-743-0988. Connect to the Financial Focus radio show on YouTube or iTunes. Listen to past shows, get our bi-weekly e-news, and keep up to date on the market. You can also sign up for our e-newsletter on our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com. Let's get back to the show.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us on Financial Focus Radio. If you'd like to sign up for our e-newsletter, Josh and I do a 5 or 6 minute video in the middle and every end of every month where we talk about markets and how they are affecting your money. You don't have to be a client to get added to our e-newsletter list. I think we're doing one next Tuesday. To get added to that list, go to our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com. Just give us your email address and we will get you added to that list. So 2026 has so far been shaping up a lot like 2021 was, where investors were sort of chasing the meme stocks, the high momentum, high beta names in the market, very similarly to what we saw in 2021. And if you remember what happened in 2022, that could be a sign of coming attractions. I would just tell you that when the crowd, that is the market, acts as if there is no risk and only reward, which is a very common theme right now. People, investors think that like what is going on in markets is normal and that there is no risk. That is ultimately the time for prudence. Now, when fundamentals get really far detached from reality, there's no telling how far it can go. And so this could obviously go on longer than anyone anticipates. But if you are a retiree, you just absolutely need to act with prudence and need to make sure that you're doing your risk management and rebalancing and all of those things, because, you know, it's getting back to, I remember in the late 90s when I had just started in the business, people talked about owning the S&P as their safe money and then they traded around it. It's like, I have my core position, which is my safe money, and then I'm going to trade like crazy. Remember, the S&P 500 in the global financial crisis went down over 50%. And so, you know, safe money in the index is not necessarily safe if you can't afford a 50% drawdown, which I don't think many of the current market participants think is in the cards. And I don't know that I believe that it's in the cards anytime in the near future, but it could be. And so this is the time when acting with prudence, because, you know, remember, if you lose 50%, you have to make 100+% to get back to even. And so that is easier said than done. So this is just the cautionary tale that we give every once in a while to
2021. Don't forget how fast the air can come out of the balloon in some of those names. It gets brutal so quickly.
Yeah, it's the escalator up, express elevator.
When you
down.
Have these companies with zero revenue until the 2030s, trading at multi tens of billion market cap. Come on.
Josh sounds like an old fuddy-duddy like me.
I know, but I mean, as we've talked about on the show like so many times, we both had like those destructive moments early in our, you know, formative Warren Buffett years where we thought we were Warren Buffett, and
market, I thought it was Jim Simon.
Market conditions. You know, we communicate this often, but there's two types of people in markets: those that have been humbled, and then those that are going to be. And it happens to everyone.
And there's a long list now of those that are going to be. I don't know if we're in the crypto winner. We've had a few crypto winners in the past. One of the most fascinating developments of 2026 has been the divergence between crypto and other risk assets. So other risk assets continue to do really well, but crypto, which is considered a risk asset, hasn't. The S&P 500 has hit 25 all-time highs in 2026, and Bitcoin is suffering its longest 252 days and deepest over 55% drawdown since 2022. So that's been really interesting. I mean, the crypto thing has never made any sense to me.
Well, but the speculative interest, as we talk about in the office all the time, it's moved on to new and shinier, you know, more immediately tangible feedback loops like prediction markets.
Where, meaning that the crypto people that own Bitcoin are just using it as a source of funds to go speculate elsewhere.
And, you know, with the flood of massive mega IPOs coming in through the end of this year, you know, there's going to be a need for a lot more new funds to buy those when they go public.
Right. So, all right. So one of the things that I thought we would talk about in this segment is, you know, taking money once you've accumulated all of your assets, you've been saving, you know, your whole working life, and now you get close to retirement or you're in retirement, and now you have all of these different accounts, and it's like, okay, they all have different tax consequences when I take withdrawals. What's the best order of how I should take this money so that I'm doing it the most tax efficiently, knowing that some of my biggest buckets are going to come out as ordinary income and that kind of thing? So first, I'll go through the sort of three major registration types on your retirement accounts, and then we can talk about how they're taxed, and then talk about a strategy by which you should go about withdrawing those funds so that you're withdrawing in the most tax-efficient way, but not leaving this huge tax liability out there in the future. So the first one is just a good old-fashioned brokerage account, a taxable brokerage account. You know, it's the same registration as like your bank or your CD. You know, in my case, it's a trust account. Josh's case is a trust account. A lot of people have joint accounts or an individual account. It's just investments that are in a taxable investment account, meaning you get a 1099 tax form every year and you're paying taxes on the dividends and capital gains and interest on an annual basis. There's no tax deferral in these. The wealthiest people in the world have the most of the money in these kind of accounts.
So, and they're really attractive if you're in those early retirement years and you have essentially no other income coming in. You can, married couples have a 0% federal tax rate on long-term capital gains below $98,000. So you can realize a bunch of gains in your taxable account in those first couple years of retirement and not have to pay any federal capital gains taxes on those long-term gains.
Then there's the traditional retirement account asset. So when I say traditional, I mean a traditional 401k, traditional 403b, traditional IRA. Those are those accounts that you put money in on a pre-tax basis. So think payroll deduction in your 401k when you were putting that money in on a pre-tax basis, meaning it doesn't get taxed. It goes in, it reduces your taxable income, gross tax deferred. But when you do take money out of any traditional retirement account, that money is going to come out as ordinary income, right? So if it's a 403b, an IRA, a traditional IRA, or 401k, any money that comes out of those that you put in on a pre-tax basis is going to come out as ordinary income. And so making sure you understand, okay, like, you know, if I'm going to take money out of this thing, it's going to add to my other taxable income. I have to understand the consequences of that. And then finally is the Roth IRA, a Roth account. So now you can do a Roth 401k, a Roth 403b, a Roth IRA. You know, Roths have only really been around since 2001. And Roth 401k and 403b options haven't been around all that relatively long either. And so these are probably the smallest pools of money out there. They're growing as we speak, but they're the smallest pools. They're obviously the most attractive pools to take money from because this is money that went into this thing on an after-tax basis. And when it comes out tax-free to whoever takes it out. And so the important point that we're trying to make is that understanding the different tax liabilities of all three of these accounts. And then when you do a withdrawal strategy, we have lots of clients that are taking proportionately from all three. So they're saying, I'm going to take let's say 40% from my non-qualified account, my taxable account. I'm going to take 20% from my traditional IRA, and I'm going to get the rest from my Roth, which is to get the amount of income that they need in retirement, but have their tax liability be ultra low on their distributions. That's sort of the name of the game. I would say that, you know, financial advisory firms like ours, that's another value add for our clients, where we can make sure they get the income they need, but in the most tax efficient manner, because a lot of people don't think about it. They're just like, I'm going to take it from this account, and they don't really think about the tax liability or the future for their kids and step ups and all that stuff.
Highly situationally specific. So there's a lot of different levers you can pull to get you to the most tax efficient overall income stream.
All right, if you have a question or a comment for the show, give us a call. The number here is 877-670-7117. Or you can always certainly email us. Go to our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com, and let us know what's on your mind. When we come back, we're going to tackle your emails, so stick around.
Sign up for our e-news today. Get the latest thoughts on the market every other week from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management delivered right to your inbox. The short 5 to 6 minute video helps you keep up with the market. You can always watch past videos on YouTube or on northwestquadrantwealth.com. You're listening to Financial Focus Radio Show, where you get honest and actionable advice every week from the partners at Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management. Remember, you can always listen to past shows on iTunes or find us on northwestquadrantwealth.com.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us on this relatively chilly weekend here in the last weekend of June. I don't know what the heck's going on. I guess it's probably good for fire season. We had a chillier than usual summer last summer also. So what is this, an El Nino or whatever year is that? Is that what this year is? I don't know what any of that crap means. I think it's like more or less rain.
I saw we're getting snow in the mountains, so yeah.
You mean this weekend?
Yeah, it's supposed to snow a couple inches in Mount Bachelor.
Well, I guess June is better than July or January, right?
So yeah, I mean, as a kid, I remember like a couple 4th of July ski days when it was, you know, intermittently snowing. So
Troy remembers going to the 4th of July parade when it snowed back in the day.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Didn't they used to have like a, we don't want to diverge too much from this. So remember that periods of extreme optimism often coincide with elevated and unrealistic expectations. Does that sound familiar right now? The higher the expectations rise, the harder they become to satisfy. Just ask my wife.
Oh, man.
Investors would be wise to remember that enthusiasm and fundamentals are not always the same thing. So the market is awash with enthusiasm right now, but I don't know that the fundamentals are going to support them. And I started to hear on CNBC last week that this time is different. And those are by far the most expensive words in the investment business.
Who told you that?
Sir John Templeton.
No. Who was the this time
Joe Jared Taranova, the Jersey guy. This time is different, Josh.
Yeah, Joe.
It's structural, Josh. It's not cyclical. It's structural.
The Terra Nova Momentum ETF.
Yeah. And I will remind people, because while I was gone serenading my wife in Italy, we had the biggest IPO in history, and that is obviously SpaceX making the first trillionaire. But I would just remind people about chasing hot IPOs. IPOs stands for initial public offering. U.S. IPOs, initial public offerings, have averaged a 6% annualized return in the 3 years following their initial listing. That's nearly half the return of the broad stock market. So there was a study done by Bloomberg that looked at IPOs since 1980 through the end of 2025. The average 3-year return after the IPO for all IPOs was about 6%, and the total stock market's return was 11.8%. So again, another reason you just don't need to worry about this stuff. Just buy the market. Investors are always chasing the hot IPO, believing they will outperform. But the reality is that most stocks underperform after going public. And so the other thing I'd caution people, because Josh fielded a lot of calls about SpaceX, and I talked to some people last week about SpaceX. Remember, companies, the employees of companies have a lockup. They have to, after the company goes public, they can't sell their shares immediately. And remember, some of these SpaceX employees have been there for 10 years and have shares that are 10 years old. And so they want liquidity on that money. They've had zero liquidity on their shares. And a big lockup happens in August. And so a bunch of employees can dump a lot of stock on the market. And historically, that's been rough for the stock price. So go back to Facebook. Obviously, Facebook's been a great stock since it went public. But the first year and a half when it was public, Facebook stock really struggled because so many of the employees wanted some liquidity.
Well, and specific to SpaceX, it was, you know, they're floating 3% of the company. And of that 3%, the majority of it's locked up or subject to some version of a restriction. So it's just a, you know, it's a very classic imbalance between supply and demand. And
right. Meaning there's going to be a flood of shares on the market. The other thing is I have no doubt that SpaceX is going to do great things in its future. I believe that to be true. What those things are, I probably can't imagine right now. But when you buy a company that trades at over 100 or 150 times sales,
200.
Yeah, the analogy to that is I gave it the analogy to this guy that wanted to buy it. Let's say you wanted to buy a convenience store that had $1 million in revenue, right? So that this convenience store has $1 million in revenue, not profit, just revenue. You would have to pay $200 million for that convenience store. That's what, say, SpaceX is trading at. So just beware that doesn't make sense, whether it's a technology company or a convenience store. Okay, let's take some email questions. We got an email from Linda W. Doesn't say where she is. My daughter and granddaughter are my IRA beneficiaries. I understand that they have to take all withdrawals within 10 years of my death, but what are the tax implications, and will they pay inheritance tax and income tax on these withdrawals? So, Linda, that's a good question. Let me just tackle what she's talking about, the first part. So as part of the Secure Act, they got rid of the stretch IRA provision. So it used to be that in Linda's case, her daughter and granddaughter could stretch Linda's IRA over their lifetime, meaning they would have to continue to take distributions, but they could stretch it out over their lifetime. As part of Secure Act, that now changed to her daughter and granddaughter have 10 years to take all of the money out of her IRA. So our recommendation to clients, because that's taxes ordinary income, is to spread those withdrawals out over a 10-year period. When you get to the fifth year, if you know you're not on track to take enough out, we just tell people to readjust and start to take more. So that's the first part she's talking about. The second part is if it's a traditional IRA, meaning, Linda, the money went in on a pre-tax basis, that money is going to come out and taxed as ordinary income. So your daughter and granddaughter, any withdrawals they take are going to have to pay taxes on that. It's going to be in income that is on top of their other income. And so that's important to understand. In terms of the inheritance tax, you know, your whole estate is used to calculate that number. So Linda, I'm going to assume you live in the state of Oregon. Our state tax threshold is very low here in Oregon. It's $1 million. The federal threshold is $15 million. So you're probably okay there. Maybe not. But if you're under $15 million estate, you don't have to pay any federal taxes. And so, yes, if you combine your whole estate, your house, your investment accounts, your estate owes estate taxes. Where that money comes from is up to your executor of your estate. So conceivably, you might have to, some of that money in the IRA could have to be used to pay the inheritance tax. But hopefully you had a great financial advisor like Northwest Quadrant, and they helped you plan to not have to take it from the IRA. We got an email from Alan in Bend. I have a significant sum invested in several annuities. I would like to switch that money to index fund and pay taxes as the money is withdrawn. Is that recommended? How would I do this? So I'll let you tackle this one for Alan.
So Alan, I'm assuming just based on your question, you know, these are in a taxable account. So the way that that works from an annuity standpoint is the gains are tax deferred. But when you take it out, they're taxable at ordinary income. If you try to take a distribution from a non-qualified annuity like this before you're 59 and a half, the gains are going to be subject to ordinary income tax plus a 10% penalty tax. So your age is kind of relevant here too. But either way, if you take a big distribution and try to move it to an index fund now, that whole gain is going to be taxable. It'll be subject to what's called the exclusion ratio. So your original basis will be excluded, but the bulk of the distribution, depending on how long you owned it, will be taxable. There's other things you could conceivably do here. A 1035 exchange into, you know, a more cost-effective annuity that utilizes index funds could be an option, and that's going to be a non-taxable event. But then you still owe ordinary income taxes on the gain. It just might make your existing allocation a little bit better. But I hope that helps answer your question. But overall, taking a big lump sum distribution just to shift it to income taxes may not be advisable depending on the size of the contract, size of the gain, everything else.
Yeah, I think we know what he's trying to do is get out of high cost investments into low cost investments, which is we certainly would recommend. It's just not easy to do. I would say, Alan, if you want, because if he does a 1035, the tax problem is just going to build over time, right?
So right, you just might be able to optimize the investment underlying investment.
Yeah, Vanguard has an annuity with Transamerica that's very low cost. You can buy index funds, but that's just going to make your income tax problem bigger down the road. So I think I would probably do a combination of both. I would move it to the lower cost annuity and then start taking withdrawals, but I would spread it out over a bunch of years to keep to not have it change my tax bracket. So hopefully that helps. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about investment grade corporate bonds, and we're now allocating those money in our accounts to those. So stick around.
Get your free one-hour retirement review. Meet with a Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management Investment Advisor today for free. It's our offer to you as a listener to the show. Give us a call today to schedule your portfolio review. 800-743-0988. Again, 800-743-0988. Thank you for joining Financial Focus Radio Show. Honest, transparent analysis brought to you every week by Tyler Simonis and Josh Finelli. Call the show anytime at 877-670-7117. We'll try to answer your question on the air in the following weeks. Now, back to the team from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us on this chilly weekend here at the end of June in the Pacific Northwest. We appreciate you spending some of it with us. So the good news is, after a really lackluster start to the year, the U.S. labor market has rebounded quite strongly. We've seen a really strong job growth starting in March, and looks like it's going to continue. Where are those jobs coming from? Well, 60% of the job gains in the U.S. over the last 3 months came in just two sectors, that is healthcare and social assistance, and leisure and hospitality. I bring this up because the labor market, if it had continued to be weak as it had started the year, the Fed would be in a real tough spot, meaning, you know, they have two mandates, full employment and price stability, meaning in dealing with inflation. And if we had seen a continuing weak in labor market, but inflation running double what they want it to be, that's a really tough spot to be in. And so the fact that the labor market is certainly strengthening, or it looks like it has been strengthening, we'll see how that goes, but it, so far so good. It really, in my opinion, clears the deck for the Fed to be hiking rates to deal with the price instability that we've seen, meaning inflation. So I think if we continue to get good jobs print, I think we get next week, we have May's print or June's print. I'm sorry. So hopefully we get another strong print so the Fed can finally deal with inflation. The other thing that has been interesting, I talked about crypto in the last segment about how we had a sort of a crypto winter. It's the one of the risk assets that's really struggled. Gold seems to be in a slumber. Back in January, silver, remember, if you remember, silver was up 64% in the month of January and gold was up 25%. Last week, they both turned negative on the year. And you might ask yourself, so why the big reversal? Well, there's this thing called reversion to the mean that's really strong force in markets. Usually it takes longer. But we've also seen a stronger dollar. You know, most of the, looks like we're going to be hiking rates. That strengthens the dollar. We've also seen higher interest rates.
It was totally driven by the debasement narrative. And then the price, of course, became self-fulfilling. I mean,
Of course.
I remember a couple months ago, I told you, like, my dad, who never ever reaches out to me about this kind of stuff, reached out and asked about gold, and I was like, oh man, this
weird.
This is one
it's
of
so
those,
weird like, how like the retail investor, not, you know, your dad's not unique in this scenario, that it's only after something's risen in value by a tremendous amount do people ask about it. That's always weird to me.
Well, and you know, that dollar debasement narrative in the midst of the extent of inflation we've seen, inflation starts to see a resurgence, and you know, it was a very powerful narrative. And now, you know, with the rise of sort of Robinhood and everything else, like the retail trader just piles into this stuff like an absolute wall of money going into these various asset classes. And gold, I don't think, was an exception. It, you know, they're just buying it through GLD or whatever else. And
sure. But in a lot of these markets, whether it's gold, silver, whatever, crypto, they're relatively small markets. So
yeah,
it doesn't take a lot of money to move them.
It doesn't take a ton of money to move them. And it's just the interest just explodes overnight. And then, you know, you have all sort of tourists in these sectors. And
they're renting them.
They just move from one focus to the next.
All right, let's talk about an exciting part of the bond market. So everybody get your pencils sharpened and get ready to take notes, because this is a real exciting subject. But if you like income, it is pretty exciting. And that is investment-grade corporate bonds. So Josh, give us a definition of what is an investment grade, that part first, and then corporate bond, and then we can talk about the investment story behind it.
Well, without getting into the weeds on the various different types of ratings from, you know, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, or Fitch, or whatever else, investment-grade corporates are just debt securities that are issued by what you would consider a financially stable corporation that has a pretty relatively low risk of default. And so these are bonds that, they provide what we would characterize as a really reliable income stream. I kind of laugh because SpaceX got rated at, you know, A or something this week by one of the ratings rating agencies. But they're not high yield or junk, so they're just the really high quality corporate bond issuers out there. The ETF that we use to get exposure to this space is called the Vanguard Short-Term Corporate Bond Index Fund ETF. The ticker symbol on that is VCSH. When you go look under the hood, what does it own? It owns the bonds of like Bank of America, AbbVie, CVS, T-Mobile, Boeing, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Pfizer. It's the blue chip bond, you know, blue chip corporate debt instruments are what it owns. And they're all short duration instruments. So, you know, it's 5 years or less. The effective duration of Vanguard short-term corporate that we use is 2.73 years. Average credit rating is over an A. The current yield is somewhere around 4.7%. We kind of wallowed into this during that dislocation in rates a couple months ago during the Iran war. But these are the blue chip corporate bonds out there. You know, there's a lot of demand for these things. So, when people are looking for yield, of course, you know, these yields relative to history are still kind of low, but relative to the last last few years of ultra low ZIRP, they look really appealing to us.
Yeah, Josh and I have finally been able to take a little bit of risk in the bond market, and that is through this, but it's still very low risk because it's so short in duration and it is investment grade. And so, you know, we're either doing it by buying these bonds individually or doing it through this fund because you can finally take a little bit of duration. Josh and I, without actually trying, look like brilliant bond managers because now we're starting to see the yield curve flatten. And so, the choice we've made we've made the choice to stay short in duration
deliberately,
very deliberately, and it's worked out quite well for our clients. I would just tell you that the idea behind owning this. So if you think about owning all these bonds in this, like the JP Morgan bond, for example, which is a big position in this ETF. You know, you're lending them money. So if you buy the stock, you're an owner of the company. If you own the bond, you're lending JP Morgan money. And you have JP Morgan has a contractual obligation to pay you the interest on that bond and then give you your principal back at the end of the bond's maturity. And so, you know, when you buy a stock, there's no contractual obligation of a return. When you buy a bond, like a JP Morgan bond, as long as JP Morgan doesn't default and they pay all their interest payments, you know exactly what your return is going to be on that bond when you buy it. You're going to have a yield to maturity and you know what the bond is going to mature at. And you know how much principal you're going to get back. So that is why investing in bonds, people like it a lot more. It's a lot more predictable. And as long as, you know, you don't go through a default cycle and you own investment grade bonds, you can map out what your returns are going to be, and you can map it out from an income standpoint.
We finally got to a place where we feel like the price sensitivity of this exchange-traded fund, you know, with respect to interest rates, you know, the yield, the extra juice that we're going to get by owning it, it eclipses that degree of price sensitivity. And it's short duration enough that, you know, the shock to upside in interest rates isn't going to dislocate that price too much. Generally, overall, we really absolutely will not take duration and with a fixed income ETF, but this is short enough duration that we're comfortable with that trade-off at this point.
All right. If you'd like to take one of us up on a free retirement review, one of us will give you an hour of our time to talk about anything in your financial life. So if you have at least $750,000, call our office to get one of those meetings scheduled, 800-743-0988, or email us, go to our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about the sequence of return risks. So stick around.
Sign up for our e-news today. Get the latest thoughts on the market every other week from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management delivered right to your inbox. The short 5 to 6 minute video helps you keep up with the market. You can always watch past videos on northwestquadrantwealth.com.